This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 9 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. In today's episode, we have Susan Wright from the NCSF. Here's our hosts, Woody and the Beast.
Thanks, Max. Hey, Beast, we got a great show tonight.
Yes, we do. We have a very, very lovely, informed, and important caller coming to us today.
Well, who would that be?
Yes, Woody, I have Susan Wright with the National Coalition for Sexual Freedom with us today on the line, coming to us to talk about their Consent Counts project and several other projects they got going on. Hello, Susan.
Hi, Beast. Hi, Woody. How are you?
We're great down here. So how's things going?
It's going really well. I was just in Nashville, and I thought it was a lovely city. I really enjoyed it.
And that was for your national conference, is that right?
Yes, that's our annual Coalition Partners meeting. It's where we plan the work of NCSF for the year ahead, and we get together with our Coalition Partners, which are groups, educational groups, businesses, who have decided to take a leadership role in NCSF.
And we appreciate the NCSF. First, let me introduce you. Susan Wright founded National Coalition for Sexual Freedom in 1997, a national advocacy organization for the BDSM, swing, and polyamory communities, and currently serves as spokesperson for the organization. She chaired the DSM-5 Revision Project, coordinated the SM Policy Reform Project for the National Organization for Women, which resulted in a change in their stance about BDSM, I understand. Susan also writes contemporary romance, urban fantasy, science fiction, and Star Trek books. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Tell us about the NCSF in general. A lot of people have heard about it vaguely, but really, you still have some work to do to get the word out to the whole community, I think.
And I think that you help with that by, you know, having me on so I can explain things like this. Because what we basically do is help people who are being discriminated against because they're kinky or because they're non-monogamous. They're in a poly relationship or they do swinging. And unfortunately, there's a lot of discrimination and persecution against our people because, you know, people don't understand what it is that we're doing. For a long time, they thought we were mentally ill. And we've had to work really hard to overcome these stereotypes. And that's what NCSF does. We talk to the media and, you know, we kind of correct their stories to try to get rid of the stigma about kinky sex and non-monogamy. And we also work directly with people who have lost their job or lost child custody because of their, you know, alternative sexual behavior. I mean, we think as long as it's consenting adults and you're not harming someone, that, you know, it shouldn't hurt you to be who you are. And so that's what NCSF was started to do. It's a coalition of these educational groups, you know, your group and businesses and, you know, just your all these local groups around the country have kind of come together to form this coalition that is kind of an umbrella that interfaces between the kink community and the vanilla world. And we try to explain what kink is so that they stop hurting us.
I understand you're having some successes at that. The NCSF was instrumental in getting the DSM-5 changed to make us less crazy. Is that right?
Well, yes. We worked with the American Psychiatric Association, and they had a bunch of different committees that were that meet like once a decade to revise their diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders. It's basically the insurance coding for mental disorders. And you know, people make their careers on these different codes and different disorders because that's what they specialize in. And so we were very lucky in being able to talk to the paraphilia subwork group. And that's what basically we're classified as a paraphilia. It's an unusual sexual interest.
I think it's usual.
Really responded to us. They hated it when they heard that, you know, people were being discriminated against. And, you know, the DSM was open in courtrooms and a judge or a prosecutor would point at it and say, see, it says here spanking and flogging, sexual sadism, you know, and it says here that if you have one paraphilia, you could have another. And another paraphilia is pedophilia. So, you know, people were getting their child custody taken away from them based on something that was not even a psychiatric evaluation. It was just somebody looking in a book and reading a few words in a book. And so to keep that from happening in the future, they actually separated it. You now have the paraphilias, which is all of our lovely, unusual sexual interests that we enjoy. And then you have the paraphilic disorders, which is a completely different thing. It's people who engage in these things with non-consenting persons. It's people who do actual harm to people in terms of, you know, they might permanently injure them. So, or they might injure themselves in a permanent way, rather than just, you know, stimulating themselves. So they kind of really make a clear difference between the two, and they even state in there that, you know, there's plenty of people in the community. Here, I have a quote if you want to hear it.
Kind oh, sure, cool. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, that they put this in an official book. It says, the majority of individuals who are active in the community networks that practice sadistic and masochistic behaviors do not express any dissatisfaction with their sexual interests, and their behavior would not meet DSM-5 criteria for sexual sadism disorder. So they really went out of their way to make sure that we were no longer swept up in the mental disorders net, and I think that that's going to have a big effect on us in the future. We're already seeing it in child custody cases.
Susan, just for the people that don't know, what is DSM-5? What's it stand for?
It's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and it's the fifth edition.
And that's used by mental health workers in helping to bill and classify various mental conditions. Is that right?
Yes, correct. And there's various ones, but the ones we were really interested in that are, you know, the sexual sadism and the sexual masochism, fetishism, and transvesticism, and that's basically cross-dressing. And so those are basically our peeps. Those are what we really focused on, and they responded by creating this new kind of split in the diagnosis. And we're seeing now, back in when this whole thing started, we were having about a 20% success rate when it came to child custody cases where BDSM was, you know, a factor. That's really low. That's like 4 out of 5. We were not able to do anything. We weren't able to fight against this. And then in 2012, we had the proposed criteria that the AP had put out. They hadn't even published this officially. And we presented that in 41 cases that were referred to us. And all of them were BDSM was removed as a factor. So I think that shows right there. This has had a really huge impact very quickly. I was actually just dealing with a family advocate in Knoxville, Tennessee, and was talking to her about this in a case that they're having. And she said, oh, yes, we all know about this. And it's not ever brought up officially anymore as a reason to deny child custody. And I thought that was great.
So that leaves people to actually have to deal with the real issues and not the pretend ones.
Exactly. I mean, there may be real issues for denying somebody custody, and that we have no comment on. I mean, I think that that's up to the courts to decide, and the family advocates certainly know the best because they're the ones on the ground. But we definitely don't want somebody just looking at a person and going, oh, you're kinky, you're an unfit parent. That's not fair. And we've managed to really turn that around.
And we appreciate that work. I know I do has a person that is interfacing with the public on a regular basis and interfacing with the kink community and seeing a lot of these people struggle with child custody issues and so forth as relationships form and break up. And we appreciate the NCSF running on the front lines. You're well into a new project about the consent counts.
Oh, yeah. You know, consent counts is a long project. It's been going on since 2007. It actually started within the community and went on for a year and a half before they kind of turned to NCSF and said, can you take this over? We think it's important. And the whole point of consent counts is to decriminalize BDSM. In much the same way we depathologized BDSM with the APA, that means we made it no longer a mental illness, we want to make it no longer automatically a crime when you do kink. And the problem is that it's tried under assault. It's not that BDSM is illegal, but assault is illegal. And unfortunately, each state law is different. And for some state laws, it specifically says, you know, reddening of the skin. For others, even if they hold true to the model penal code for assault, which it has to be a serious physical injury for it to be considered assault if it was done consensually, well, the courts actually look at things like a riding crop or a hot wax or a baton on the inside of the thigh. There's definite cases that we have where those things were considered serious physical injury.
And I might add, Susan, that in some of these cases, you didn't have a victim. You had a willing, eager participant that was the case was brought on their behalf by a third party. Is that correct? In some of these cases?
Yeah, yes, we've definitely had cases. I mean, that goes back to actually like the famous UK case, Spanner, where it was a group of men who were actually doing BDSM together, and they were tried, and some of the submissives actually died in jail because they were in prison for this. So they don't really care. They don't even really look at consent in terms of these cases. We don't have a single appellate ruling in which consent is considered a defense for assault. And in some ways, that's kind of because we've been very successful on just the case level. When a case is first tried, it's a criminal case, we can get in there, and we've been able to influence certain cases in terms of pointing out that this is consensual and does not rise to the level of assault. But we also have cases in which that are kind of even more muddied, where laws like trafficking laws are brought in, things like battery, domestic violence cases, which we don't even see the light of day. Those are usually kept very quiet because they don't want to broadcast the victim's name or particulars. But those are the cases where we're seeing a lot of times it is completely consensual. It's two people having a scene in their house, and somebody hears outside and calls the police. The police come, and some states have mandatory arrest laws where they must arrest somebody, particularly if they see the other person is distressed in any way, partially nude, any sort of marks. It's a real issue. We need to do the same thing as we did with the American Psychiatric Association and explain what consent is in a BDSM context so that these laws can be enforced in a more reasonable way. And so that's one reason why the Consent Counts Project has been taking so much time, because we needed to find out what does the kink community think is consent. And so we've been doing surveys on it.
And considering how diverse and complex our community we are, you found, I suspect, that the definitions of consent varied widely within the community itself.
Yes, and it's interesting because our first survey, the NCSF Consent Count Survey, kind of asked questions in different ways. And there were actually some contradictory findings. So what we did was we took that out and we held discussions around the country about this. And based on those discussions, we kind of came back and we created a consent violation survey that really drove down more. For example, somebody could say, I got my consent violated. Well, how? Was it done on purpose? Was it an accident? Was it lack of skills? Was it lack of communication? It turns out there's a whole lot of other reasons than the, first of all, when you look at it black and white, my consent was violated. In fact, some people were even coming to us and saying, my consent was violated, but it was part of our dynamic, and I was okay with it. So it was very interesting for us to, eye-opening, to look at consent in these ways that we hadn't really thought about, even people who've been in the community this whole time. So we've had just amazing years of discussions about consent, and we finally created the statement on consent, the NCSF statement. Pretty much, you know, goes through what consent is and kind of checks off, you know, it's not coercion, it's not manipulation. You know, it's done in a sound mind, you know, with other adults. Some pretty basic tenets of what the community can agree, in particular like educational and social groups that are sort of the backbone of our community and are teaching people how to do BDSM in a consensual way. And they agree on these basic tenets.
So there is some agreement that's coming together here as we pull our communities together and talk and force this conversation to move forward.
Yes, and I think that the big variables are when we come down to look at activities versus relationships. And that's been very eye-opening as well. And not just master-slave relationships, but some people are in the DS relationships that don't have a lot of the actual, you know, familiar BDSM-like activities in it. It's more of an emotional, psychological relationship than a flogging, spanking, things of that sort, more ritual-based. And in those relationships, we often see people will get consent at the very beginning of the relationship. So how do they deal with withdrawing consent? We've had to have like some real discussions with the master-slave community in particular, and put forth a master-slave statement that, you know, it's still, you know, being considered, and we're ready to take more input on it. But it also lays out different ways that people deal with withdrawing consent, either, you know, retraining, a calm period, you know, kind of a separation, a formal release. I mean, there's different ways, and it's very important that we as a community put those different ways out that a relationship can be ended and consent can be withdrawn, because you can never let go of the fact that we will never be able to change the basic fact that as human beings, we can withdraw consent at any moment, no matter what we've agreed to before or ideally what we would like to be able to hold to. The law will not change that we can withdraw consent at any moment. And so any master who is playing with a slave, for example, who thinks that once they sign a contract that they have proof that, you know, if they withdraw consent, well, they can use that in their defense. It's actually, contracts are often used against a top in those cases, because you can't legally give your right to consent away.
The survey itself is still an ongoing project. You're still making surveys available to people. Is that correct?
Yes, the consent violation survey. The first survey we did was over, and we have the results of that one. But the consent violation survey is underway right now. We have over 3,500 people have responded. It will probably be open until the beginning of May. We would love for everyone to take it, even if you haven't had a consent violation, because we take important demographic information as well. We ask if people are out. We also ask about things like, you know, touching in social spaces. Have you ever been, you know, just touched? Have you ever had abuse when you were a child? So those sorts of things that give us really important information on our community as a whole. So we're asking everyone to take it, and, you know, it can be as short as 3 or 4 minutes or as long as 20 minutes if you want to go into detail about incidents that have happened to you.
But 3,500 surveys, that's a very small amount considering the size of our community. The FetLife population is almost 2 million now, I believe.
Yeah, that's not the FetLife population. A lot of people have double profiles. A lot of people come in and create a profile.
I understand. But so we will say a conservative 300,000. People,
and
that 3,500
like
is still
1%.
Yeah, it's still a very small amount. So more data is
needed.
According
to, you know, what people do with studies, it's an opt-in survey. That's one of the, probably the biggest issue, is that people are self-selecting who goes in. So I think since it's called consent violation survey, you're going to get more people who are particularly interested in that to opt in. So you have to look at the results that way. But for an internet survey, it's actually considered to have a quite a large number.
Oh.
We're hoping to get to 5,000 if we can. You know, most of our surveys, we've had about 3,000, like our violence and discrimination survey. That was considered a sound survey. It was a representative sample. But, hey, I would love to have 10,000 if we could.
The more the merrier, right?
Yes.
What is some of the other works that the NCSF is involved in?
Well, NCSF always needs volunteers. We do things like, we have a newsletter that gets this information out to people. We have the media updates where we look at all the news that comes out every day. And if it has something to do with kink or non-monogamy, we'll put it on our blog and we'll put it on our Facebook page. So you can check out the Facebook page for, you know, interesting stories about our community. And it's interesting to see how it's kind of switched. It was very negative for a long time about us, and it's, you can see kind of a wave has happened, that more tolerance is happening and more positive articles. I mean, the idea of polymarriage was never broached before last year, and if it was, it was the slippery slope warning and a gay marriage fight, but now it's actually really being discussed as a viable option. So it's very important for NCSF to be involved in the media and to have an impact on that. We also have the Kink Aware Professionals, which is a database of therapists, lawyers, massage therapists, you know, people who are professionals who, it's important for kinky people to be able to access somebody who's kink aware or kink friendly. For example, you would probably want to go see a therapist who is at least kink aware. Otherwise, you spend a lot of time trying to explain what BDSM is, and you can hit up against somebody who's, you know, bigoted or prejudiced, and it can impact on you very badly. And especially with things like doctors, who, if you might have marks on you, they're mandatory reporters. So it's best if you can either educate your own doctor, and we have pamphlets on how to do that and how to find a kink aware doctor if there's not one in your area in the database. And that's basically what NCSF has. If you go to our website, we've got information on everything, how to deal with assault, to how to find a BDSM therapist, to a whole list of presentations that we give around the country that educate people on things like this.
And all those links for the NCSF will be on our page under their hot links.
So, Susan, the NCSF is growing in power every year, which is great. What can the community do to help the NCSF?
Well, we need to, we want to get this information out. For example, as you said, we need to make sure everybody knows about NCSF. We can't help people who are being discriminated against if they don't know enough to talk to us. And especially if it's like a criminal case, we want to know about it right away so we can help and give the information that we have, you know, maybe assist in finding a kink aware lawyer, so that we don't get bad case law made. So we kind of all have to network together to let everybody know what's going on. And part of that is also, you know, sexual freedom is not free. I donate all of my time. We're all volunteers at NCSF. But it takes money to get to conferences, to do these presentations, to pay our phone bills so that we can have our incident reporting and response number open. And, you know, to have the website going. And we do this on very little money, considering that we are advocating for, as you point out, conservatively 300,000 people. It's kind of crazy that we don't have an organization that is bigger and even more powerful. I think that we're on the cusp of something here, that if we can all join together as members of NCSF to do fundraisers for NCSF, but in particular, I think members, we need numbers. Not just coalition partner numbers, but individual member numbers to say we represent 10,000 people and we represent 100,000 people. As we know today, that carries weight. And we've seen it with all of our projects. When we can kind of put the weight of the community and the number of people behind it, we can really make things happen. I mean, we went out there early in the early 2000s and fought with the hotel companies because they were shutting down events. They were canceling contracts on kink events. And we got out there and we fought, particularly in the Midwest. You know, it was IML in Chicago. It was Beat Me in St. Louis and a few other events. And we had to fight them on the ground every single event because they were trying to, like, raise, oh, my gosh, you can't allow this to happen in our city. You can't allow this to happen in this hotel. And we managed to fight them and got all of the hotels, the big chains, one after the other, to agree. And that's why we've had a decade of all these big events at hotels where we've been able to grow. You know, we've been able to really mushroom and help our businesses thrive so that they aren't discriminated against. And that's what we need to do more.
And some of our newer members to the community are unaware of these early days when we were very much more underground, very cautious with our events, and before we had these large 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 person events happening around the country on a regular basis.
Right, and it's been so key because we all get together and then we take that back to our own community, you know, and it's just amazing how the community has grown and is thriving. And don't you feel like it? Don't you feel like we're kind of on the cusp of something really big here, especially the new people that are coming in?
I think the events coming together, well, we have to credit 50 Shades for helping us bridge the gap with the mainstream community and getting more of the positive press, I think, from the media.
Without a doubt, it's totally true. And I know that some people in the BDSM community don't really like the book, but, you know, that Sui Lu romance novel did more for our community than anything else because it's barely kinky. It made it accessible to millions of people. And you can see by the tone of the coverage. I mean, we basically documented media coverage since 1997. And several years ago, actually like 2.5 years ago, it completely started changing. And it was with the giant 50 Shades of Grey hoopla. And I think with the movie coming out next year, we'll see another big bump in interest. And we need to make sure that we have the infrastructure in place for all these people who come in and just want to find out how to do this safe and consensually.
Now, with this shift in perception by the media, have we saw a shift in the way cases are reported that might have a BDSM link? Are they more sensationalized or less?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Not only just BDSM, but it's kind of lapped over into the poly and spin community as well. It used to be that the coverage was relentlessly negative when we first started this. Into the early 2000s, even to the mid-2000s, it was all about what the local swing club that was busted and, the dire rule, beware the children, and, religious political extremists like the Americans for Truth About Homosexuality would go to Folsom Street Fair and take pictures, and, oh, my God, this is what horror is happening, attacking college groups for taking money from the college for their groups. We still have problems with that. But it really changed. I mean, it started to change with the surge of the BDSM groups because, you'd start to see lifestyle articles, where it was more covering it from, there's this interesting group here. You can learn about kink. And then with 50 Shades of Grey, it just burst. And we're just seeing so much more of a tolerant focus. I mean, that's normally what I would have to do is go in and tell, fight with the editor to change the sex dungeon uncovered to, possible civil rights abuse of alternative sexuality. I would be the one trying to get them to stop being so sensationalistic. And I haven't had to do that.
That was the you all had some big wins, NCSF did, with the Attleboro, Massachusetts case, I believe, in changing the coverage from a negative about the people to a issue about civil rights violations. Is that correct?
Yes, definitely. That was one of our early ones, Attleboro, which is what it was commonly known in the community. That was where there was a party going on in a sort of a semi-industrial living space, and the police were in the building looking for music equipment, and they happened to stumble on this party. And it was a, kink party, and it was basically spontaneously doing a raid on the party. And they arrested a woman for spanking another woman with a wooden spoon. And they arrested the owner of the party for, all sorts of things, including obstructing an officer. And so we had to raise a ton of money for that. But the biggest problem for us was we wanted to make sure that the coverage did not harm the rest of the community there in Massachusetts, which is actually fairly conservative for all the fetish fair flea market that they have. I think that's one reason why they really pushed that as a big event to kind of get the word out to as many people as possible. But having a party in Boston and Massachusetts is difficult because of the law. So that was one thing that we helped in quite a bit. And we've had a lot of success. The media has, in my opinion, wants a different twist on the story. And if you can give them, the twist is that these aren't scary, freaky people. These people are being hurt because you think they're scary and freaky people. And for the majority of times, I've had editors and I've had writers respond to that. And that's why I'm a big believer. If you're contacted by the media and it has something to do with kink, contact NCSF and we will help you. I mean, I've done more intervention for individuals who've been outed somehow or have outed themselves thinking it would be okay and then it turns out to be a problem than anybody. I mean, I enjoy helping people when they're having to deal with the media.
What about the law enforcement? Are we seeing a shift in the law enforcement's attitude as the mainstream shifts?
It's delayed. It is not in sync with the societal shift that we're seeing right now. I think it's a few steps behind, and according to our consent violation survey that we're doing right now, I was able to go in and start looking at some of the preliminary numbers. And whereas people are saying that if they are injured in a in an attack in a BDSM context, hospitals are very responsive to them and social services are, but law enforcement is not helpful. And I think that tells us something. That's one thing we're going to have to work on. I think we live in a society that does not encourage prosecutions for sexual assault, period. I think sexual assaults are just swept under the rug. They're difficult cases. I think that that's part of it, that, prosecutors see, you said yes to this, this, and this, but you said no to that. That makes it a hard case to prove. But what we're starting to do right now is try to work with communities where there's serial predators, where there's victims, you know, several victims who are reporting something. That's the cases that law enforcement really wants to deal with. And encouraging people, even if it's just one victim, to report it to the police, because it doesn't go any further than that. It's not like you, if you report it to the police, suddenly you're going to be up in a witness stand. We're trying to educate people that if you report it, it basically just puts the law enforcement on notice that this guy did something wrong to you. That doesn't mean he's going to be prosecuted right there. But if he does something wrong to somebody else, then they start having a case. So unless somebody is actually physically injured, it's very, very difficult to get them to take it seriously. Like if you end up having to go to the hospital, you know, you have a broken arm or something like that, they will take that more seriously. But we want them to be able to take it seriously when it doesn't rise to the level of that.
I understand also you're working on, for the first time this year, a continuing education program for attorneys?
Yes, we have our continuing legal education program, and we have already created it. What we will need to do is launch it this year, and that's to educate lawyers about consent. I think it's a good first step. We will hopefully roll that out and just continue it every year and then use that as the basis for developing something that's to educate police departments. That would be the next thing to do. But I think that will have a big impact on this problem. If we can educate the lawyers, then we've made a huge stride forward.
Susan, it sounds like you all got a lot of great work going on, and we appreciate the NCSF and you yourself for that, continue that great work. Is there anything else?
Thank you.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners before we go?
No, I think that's it. Become a member of NCSF. We're going to do a big membership drive this summer, and it's specifically to just get hundreds, if not thousands, of people to sign up so that as we're going to prosecutors and law enforcement, you know, we have some heavy hitting behind us. So I really appreciate that you took the time to talk to us and help spread the word about NCSF.
And to join NCSF, what is the price?
It's $25 for an individual, and for a coalition partner or supporting member, it's $100 a year.
Susan, thank you for joining us. That was most informative. Thank you and NCSF for the great work that you're doing.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and we'll be glad to come back and talk about some other things that you're interested in.
We would love to hear from you very soon.
All right. Thank you.
Hey, Beast, it's mailbag time.
It's bulging again.
Yeah, here we go.
I have a question from our bashful box. A man writes, "Sex and play in hotels is my question. I travel for work and try to hook up when on the road. I'm pretty successful in meeting women in bars and online, but since I'm away from home, the only common place to play is the hotel room I'm staying in. Sometimes it gets loud and I have had neighbors pound on the wall or call the front desk. I want to stop short of a visit from the police. What are your recommendations to avoid problems with the hotel?"
Caller, first thing, I want your little black book. I want all the names and numbers. Second thing, the ball gag is a wonderful invention.
Oh, harsh.
Yes. There's not much to be done in your situation, caller. It's a matter of that it's bound to happen. You can request rooms away from the rest of the hotel, and sometimes they will honor that. You're just wanting some peace and quiet is the reason you want away from the rest of the guests. Having a nicer room, such as a suite, will sometimes give you more room. The television's always your best friend. However, it can be quite distracting. And we will have on an upcoming episode, caller, some tips with how to deal with these problems if they should come knocking at your door. Personally, I've had that hotel call on more than one occasion when I got a little too rowdy with my play partners.
Dare I say ambitious?
No comment.
When I've stayed in hotels with the intent of playing, I've always asked for an end room or something like that that is away from people, and I do ask for the privacy angle, and usually have had some pretty good luck with it, and I don't think I've ever had anybody pound on a wall. That does remind me of a story that happened to me at a hotel. It was in the Los Angeles area a number of years ago, And it was one of those weekends of play. Long about Saturday night at dinner time, we did have to go down to the front desk and say, by the way, can you have somebody go fix the bed? Because we had broken it somewhere in the play in the afternoon. Couldn't sleep on it that night. Things like that do happen. Guess what? All the hotel people, they've heard of this many times. It is not a surprise. I can't say that's true with my partner, who will be on the upcoming BDSM Nightmares, and she'll tell you some rather interesting hotel stories.
Caller, best of luck. And again, you can forward me that contact list via our website, because I want to meet some of these women.
With us on the phone is Uncle Abdul from lovely Silicon Valley, and he has some news on a new play space. Hi, Unc.
Hey, hi, Woody. How are you?
I'm good. So what's happening out there?
A bunch of us have been putting together and working on for a little over a year now, trying to get a new dungeon started in the San Jose area to service all the people in the San Francisco, South Bay area, the Silicon Valley area. We're very close on that.
How close are you?
We're in the process of trying to locate a space, and you know, we're still aiming for opening sometime in the first half of this year.
That's coming up here pretty quick.
That's coming up pretty quick, yes indeed.
I've been following your information that you've been putting out on the webpage, and you have quite a following. I guess there's quite a demand for it.
That's correct. There used to be two other spaces that were here before. The first was the Scenery, which operated in the Santa Clara and then later the Hayward area, but that had to close down several years ago. And that was followed by another place called Edges, and Edges existed in the Santa Clara area. That also had to close down because of some regulatory and zoning issues. There's been quite a longing and demand for having another play space in the area. There is a very sizable and very close community here in the South Bay to travel to some of the other dungeons in the area. The distance is preclusive. It would be nice if we had something that was local, that you didn't have to travel far to. Because these dungeons wind up being more like social clubs where you can whip your sweetie if you wanted to, or just hang out and, you know, talk about the latest kink adventure or just be with fellow kinky folk. There are a lot of munches in the area, but that's in a more public venue. It's kind of hard to talk about kinky stuff when you're even in a private room in a restaurant, because there's always the neighbors at the other tables that are kind of looking at you askance and wondering why everybody's laughing at the loud jokes and things of that sort.
And listening very carefully to...
Yes, we need a dungeon here, and the South Bay spot is trying to fill that.
Well, that sounds great. Keep us informed on that, and we'll let everyone know if we have local kinksters in the South Bay area that want to come out and join.
Absolutely. We'll be having different events. As soon as we open something, we'll be sponsoring different events and different parties, having other groups in the area also making our space available.
Well, I look forward to being at the grand opening.
All right. So watch for the announcements on FetLife, because as soon as it opens, we're going to be needing a lot of volunteers to help get the place ready, a lot of members to come in and enjoy the community action.
The South Bay spot will be open in late April. Check their website, thesouthbayspot.com. See it in our hot links. Or check groups in FetLife, South Bay Spot. Sounds great. Thanks, Unc. Talk to you soon.
You have been listening to episode 9 of the Kinky Cast. We want to hear from you. We also want to hear your BDSM nightmares. So email us, questions@kinkycast.com, or call and leave a voicemail at 916-KINKY69. If you leave a contact number, we will try to reach you to join us on the show. Some listeners want to remain completely anonymous, so we have the Bashful tab on our webpage. Just type your message and hit send. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and Cassie, I'm Max. See you next week.